You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
You may have a diversionary tactic of 20 youths on the other side of the wall throwing stones over while somebody throws a ladder against the wall and jumps it.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you follow us in your podcast app or join our emailing list at coldwarconversations.com. In this episode, we talk again with Paul Grant, the author of Coercion, the fourth book about the Schultz family who live in Berlin. His books are set at the end of the Second World War and the start of the Cold War. Coercion is set in 1962 against the backdrop of the Berlin Wall, and while it is still barbed wire and a fragile wall, escape attempts are frequent, and these attempts are the major theme of Paul's latest book. If you can spare it, I'm asking you to contribute at least $3 per month to help keep us on the air. Larger amounts are welcome too. Plus, you get this year's most sought-after household accessory, the Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, as a monthly financial supporter. You also bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. Co-host James conducts our chat, and I'm delighted to welcome Paul Grant back to our Cold War conversation. Before we begin this episode, I want to highlight our friends at the Cold War channel on YouTube. I've been watching their quality videos for some time, and I highly recommend them. The videos are presented in an easily digestible format and cover some fascinating and sometimes little-known Cold War subjects. From the Kyshtym disaster, the biggest nuclear disaster before Chernobyl, to the anti-Soviet guerrilla war in the Baltics, the episodes on Cold War TV provide a fantastic insight into areas of the Cold War not covered elsewhere. Just search for Cold War TV on YouTube. And now, back to our episode.
You're the author of four very good books set in Berlin, Caught in the Mousetrap, Reaping the Whirlwind, Uprising and Coercion, which is your latest book, a book that I had the great privilege to read a pre-edition version of and enjoyed it massively. But could you perhaps tell us a little bit about how Coercion fits with the other three books that you've written?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, Coercion set in 1962, so it is really about the time around the first year of the wall or the city being divided. So it's an almost the anniversary of the 13th of August 1961 when the city was divided. So it's very much a fluid and very almost dangerous time in the city in terms of what was going on locally, and also the geopolitics between the Soviet Union and the US as well. But really, going back to the other books, I mean, Mousetrap is as I said, is 61, and that is set over sort of a week, 10 days, when the city was divided. So it's very much in the early days when the Berlin Wall wasn't really the Berlin Wall. It was maybe one roll of barbed wire with tanks and a lot of personnel, maybe two rolls of barbed wire, and then you start with the rudimentary first generation breeze block walls, which is what leads into, if you like, Coercion from there. And Reaping the Whirlwind is actually going back in time. It's a prequel to the second in the series, if you like. It's a prequel to Caught in the Mousetrap. So that's set in Stalingrad and in Russia, And also, of course, in Berlin, so it's 1942, and then going on the last days of the war as the Russians close in on Berlin with the, let's say, the Schultz family very much in the midst of the storm, so to speak. And then Uprising, which is the third in the series, perhaps the title tells its own story. Mm-hmm. It's about the workers' uprising. It was, of course, all over East Germany, not just in Berlin, but it's mainly set in Berlin and around that time. So Coercion then is the sequel to the first book in the series, because it's 62 after 61. But I think it can be read alone. As a standalone novel. I think it's also you see a lot of TV serials now, you read a lot of books where actually they fill in the backstory afterwards. So if you wanted to read Coercion, it's really possible to go back and read the other books afterwards to find out about the characters and where they fit into the story. And they all appear at different times, sometimes as a main character in one of the books and sometimes as a more, you know, minor character in some of the books. So that's really how they all fit together. It's 1, 2, 3, and 4. You don't have to read them in that order. You can read them really as you like, I would say.
So what is going on in Berlin in 1962 that made it such a good place in which to set a book?
Yeah, I mean, if you're interested in the Cold War, of course, many of your listeners are, I've listened to a lot of the podcasts, which are absolutely fantastic. Such a varied number of different people, such a varied number of topics, and my interest is, you know, I'm a bit biased. It's really about mainly about Berlin, but obviously the Cold War stretched to many continents and many different places. So in 62, it's a time when, if you know about the history, you kind of take it for granted. Everybody realizes the war was there, and it was seen as, in later years, it was something which was immovable, and it was it's almost like it had always been there. But of course, now it's been down longer than it was actually there for. But it's also, in those days, it was very early. And there were many people who were ready to challenge, let's say, the legitimacy of the wall. Many of the West Berliners, for example, some people in East Berlin who were trying to get out. Even at the time, in sort of August 61, you read a lot of the first-hand accounts, and people were quite relaxed about it. In some ways, many of the East Berliners, they said, it won't last long. It's happened before. The war, you know, the city from time to time was divided before 61. You know, the a lot of the checkpoints, not so much checkpoints, but at least the border areas were closed off for a short length of time. And a lot of people thought that would just be the case. But as the months went by, from sort of August into the winter, 61, 62, and the barbed wire became, you know, let's say, very rudimentary and poorly put together breeze block walls with you know, the Y frames on the top, which is essentially where we are. If you've ever seen the pictures of the Berlin Wall, you're looking at that first generation wall with a breeze block. You may have seen some of the pictures with the kids looking through the cracks in the concrete, the walls. You've got a kind of Y frame on the top with three or four strands of barbed wire. That's what the wall looks like at this time, more often than not, in most places. Of course, in some places, it's a waterway. It could be in a forest area. But essentially, it is this kind of rudimentary breeze block in a lot of areas by this time. So 6 months on, 9 months on, people are getting used to it but not liking it. You've got, let's say, you've got a very, there's still something like, I would say, 50 to 60 people a week escaping across, so a handful of people every day escaping across the border one way or another. People are being shot at There's often incidents at the border where youths in West Berlin are throwing things over the wall at the guards, stones, different things. Sometimes that's a prelude to a very, it's not unsophisticated escape attempt. You may have a diversionary tactic of 20 youths on the other side of the wall throwing stones over while somebody throws a ladder against the wall and jumps it. It's so much like this at this time. Often the West Berlin police are firing tear gas back at the East Berlin police, the Vopos and the border guards. It's a time of great fluidity and a time when there was a challenge to what was there, which meant, of course, the authorities in East Berlin, as they were, absolutely determined to stop all escapes. As I said, 50 to 60 people a week versus 2 to 3,000 people, at any one time at Marienfeld during 1961, which led them to actually close the border. So very different numbers, of course. But, to know the sort of lengths that the East Germans would go to ensure that these escapes or attempted escapes or anything else were stopped were very lengthy, were very meticulous, petty at times. It really is quite an unbelievable time in terms of it's almost fanatical the lengths they go to stop and to prevent these types of escapes. There's still a fear, I think, within the East German regime of rebellion. The 1953, the events of 1953 are very much still in the mind. So they use the MFS to flood, and I don't think that's an underestimate. It's not something which is exaggerated, to flood, let's say, West Berlin with informants. Be they, let's say, small-time villains, people who've been stopped on the border with contraband, maybe more better trained agents. But these people were, let's say, pushed off into West Berlin to find out about escape attempts, to listen to gossip, to be around the border, really to get a raft of information. And really, they were, in many ways, quite successful in doing that, because, a lot of the tunnels, a lot of the sewer escapes, a lot of the just general escapes and families getting ready to leave because they've been, escape attempts have been organised, they were aware of it. Increasingly, because they had such vast number of informants at different levels, some, let's say, not so reliable, but some quite reliable, across West Berlin. And I think that's something which you can't underestimate. There was this paranoia within the East German regime, which was able to get to know about a lot of these tunnels, a lot of these projects that were going on during this time. So we're in a really fluid period, something very, I suppose it felt temporary at the time. And from both sides, or certainly from the DDR side, they were trying to make it permanent because they wanted to stop the flood of refugees and make sure they solved their problem continued with hopefully building their own economy and building their own fledgling country, which it was fledgling at this time, really fledgling. And then, on the West Berlin side, you had people, missing families, denied the right to study. You had very intelligent people in East Germany who were carrying out menial tasks, compared to their education, because they were, seen as border crossers in August 1961 and before that time. And they were punished, you know, in a very harsh and strong way to not be able to continue their studies. So a lot of the tunnel projects and the escape attempts were made by students and around the, I think it's Technical University at that time, to be able to get students and colleagues out of East Berlin to be able to continue their studies, because they'd be denied the right to go to university in East Germany at that time. So that's, if you like, the East German side of it. From the West German side, you've got the mayor of Berlin, Willy Brandt, who was, let's say, I think he said something like, we'll protect the West Berliners, but we won't protect the wall. So there was a clear guideline to the West Berlin police that they were to help the escapers when they happened at this time. So between from August 61 onwards, there was a very clear guideline. It very much changed afterwards because of the danger and, let's say, the some of the tragic events that happened afterwards. But this time, you know, the West Berlin police were essentially told and armed to be able to help escapers when it happened, when these events happened. So and of course then you've got the Americans and the Russians. The Americans, who were very let's say the Allies, but essentially we're talking about the Americans, who were finding it difficult to deal with people like, JFK didn't get along with Willy Brandt, because he was very strong with him during the crisis in August 61 when the city was divided. From an American and Allied point of view, there was pretty much a view that the wall was better than another war, and that's what they saw coming from that. And if the message, let's say, informal message went back to the Russians more than the East Germans, let's say, because the East Germans essentially weren't recognised by the Allies, that, in their half of Berlin or their sector of Berlin, essentially, what they did was their business. And I think that was very much seen and accepted by the Allies. So in the middle, you've got the normal Berliners, which is essentially what the book is about, what all my books are about. It's the normal people and how they are affected by this kind of superpower, geopolitical spheres of influence between the US and the Soviet Union. There's all sorts going on. I think even some of the escapes were so horrific in many ways. There was the example of I can't think of his first name. I think it's Gregory Toews, but he was 14, and he was reprimanded for not handing out Communist Party or the SED Party leaflets. So he escaped through the Invaliden Cemetery, and he swam the Humboldt Canal. So we're very close to the Reichstag, around the museum itself, for the people that know Berlin now. And he was shot as a 14-year-old for trying to escape by these German guards. He was shot through the lung, I think through the arm, through the leg, but he managed to make it to the other side of the canal. And he was dragged out of the water by the West Berlin police, who by this time were under fire by these German border guards. They then returned fire, and whilst the young chap survived in the end, one of the East German border guards was actually shot, and he died. So, of course, there was a huge propaganda story from the East German side. They actually took a photograph of his body, with eyes staring open, and they put it on the front page of a daily newspaper the horror of this, and they basically said that he was enticed by the West Berliners, even the West Berlin police, and assassinated essentially. So you've got these kind of things going on, and these are, let's say, weekly events at the very, you know, at the very least, even sometimes daily events.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
It's hard to explain today what was going on in 61, 62, wasn't it? Because everybody sees the Berlin Wall as something so permanent at that time, of course. Many people were surprised when it came down. But, you know, 61, 62, there was a huge challenge to its legitimacy and the credibility of these Germans.
I think that's what makes Berlin in the Cold War so fascinating, to think of a major metropolitan area in the center of Europe being divided physically by a wall, and why, you know, we come back to it sort of again and again. But without giving too much away, could you give us an outline of the plot in Coercion?
Yeah, sure. I could start with a couple of characters, because that it fits, if you like, the story itself. There's a teenager. He's 16. He's called Gert Brown. He's actually in Mousetrap, and he appears as a kind of young, cheeky chappy, very a little bit dodgy, if you like, to use a better word. He had a finger in a lot of pies. He was always doing deals with different people, but his heart was in the right place. He was a very, you know, loyal person. He's a little bit more serious in Coercion. Things have moved on a little bit. He's found a girlfriend who he's in West Berlin, and she is in East Berlin. And that's his motivation, if you like, to get involved. He's not one to be, he's not one to be shy in terms of getting to know, the underworld of West Berlin, and he gets involved in the Fluchthelfer organizations, the escape helper organizations, because he's just the type of person that he is. He was going backwards and forwards to East Berlin selling magazines and this kind of thing, and that's how he met his girlfriend. So it's no real surprise that he ends up with these kind of people in West Berlin. And to be honest, you know, the reputation of a lot of these the escape organizations wasn't wonderful, mainly because of a lot of the propaganda from East Berlin. They were saying that they were selling places on escape tunnels. People had to pay. They were bribing people. It was, you know, basically like they called it a human trafficking type thing. That's how these Germans put it across. And he was involved in these crews who were, digging many tunnels. There were two kind of groups. There was a kind of group around, as I've touched on already, student organizations, universities, etc., young engineers who were trying to help their friends who they used to study with before the city was divided, get across back to West Berlin to be able to study again, to continue their studies, because they'd been denied the right in East Germany. And then this group of kind of more working class guys who were just trying to get to family, sisters and brothers and mothers and fathers across, who didn't manage to get across as the wall was, or the city was divided. So he gets involved. They're a very suspicious group. They're close-knit. They're tetchy from hours of digging in the dark. There's a lot of suspicion because of the informants that they hear and suspect are around the place. And of course, a lot of them are extremely fanatical in what they're doing. They're focused on what they're doing. They hate the Stasi and the East Germans with a passion more often than not, because of the, you know, the tactics that they get up to, the things they've done to family members who've tried to escape, or because they've escaped, you know, that the family members are, let's say, held to held in some way responsible or imprisoned because of that. So he's he goes across, he gets, let's say, paperwork which enables him to go backwards and forwards as a courier for a lot of these escape, the Flughelfers, with passports to give to people, with paperwork telling people where they need to be able to get to an escape tunnel or somewhere in the barbed wire fence, let's say in more rural Berlin, some of the park areas and this kind of thing. So he's involved in, he's heavily involved, and he falls in love with an East Berlin girl who he's known for a while before the wall went up, and he wants to, or he believes she wants to come to East Berlin. And he gives her the option because he's working on one particular tunnel at this time. So that's, if you like, Gert Braun. And then there's Hans Erdmann, who is he's an NVA colonel who we met in Mousetrap, who was, let's say, part of the, well, we also met him in Uprising as a smaller part, but he was in the operation to seal Berlin, seal East Berlin, or the Soviet sector at that time. And let's say he was, I don't want to give too much away, to be honest. I can't really say too much. But essentially, something happened at the end of Mousetrap. There was, let's say, an escape attempt. He was there. And coercion starts with, because he got shot at that time, so coercion starts with him in a hospital bed, telling, or not recanting the story, but at least hinting what happened and how really everything's not quite what it seems. So Hans Erdmann is appearing to want to defect to West Berlin, but let's say he still wants to get out in coercion. That's essentially, he still wants to defect in coercion. I don't think that's giving too much away, but those are the two main characters. And then there are, let's say, lots of characters that we've seen in the other books as well.
That's one thing about this book in conjunction with all the other books, is there are many twists and turns as the grayscale of life in Berlin in the period plays itself out, which is indeed what I think makes a book so readable. But so how did you do your research for this book and indeed for your other books? Is it a lot of time spent in the archives, or do you sort of approach it different ways?
I think because I'm such a, let's say, a fan of this period, you know, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners are the same. You read so many different things over the years. You pick up so many things. I've been to Berlin many times. So that the history is kind of indelibly marked on you. You understand, you know the stories. I mean, one of the sad things for me is that I know the streets of Berlin by name. The map is in my head, which is a bit, it might come across a bit strange to people. I even know that city better than where I live now in terms of names of streets. Obviously, I know where to go now, but I know Berlin by the street names, and many of the street names have changed over time as well. Let's say after World War II, and then again after the fall of the DDR, if you like. So all those things are indelibly marked. So when I go out there, I mean, the big thing for me, of course, I'm not writing these wonderful nonfiction books like Frederick Taylor, or you know the Tunnels book that Greg Mitchell wrote as well. I'm not so they, obviously they have to be very factual and very clear. The research has to be meticulous. When you're writing fiction, at least you've got the sort of free hand, of course, to be able to base it on the history. But you have a free hand, let's say, to change things slightly, to adapt it, but taking the inspiration from things that actually happen. So I find myself quite lucky to be able to do that. And to be quite honest, yes, the research is there. It's from, you know, first-hand interviewed accounts, from reading these books, from going to and some of the wonderful museums that they've got in Berlin for all these different topics. But I find going there and going to the places where a lot of these events took place is far more inspirational to me. And looking at some of the old photographs, I mean, on Twitter, I put out the old photographs all the time. There's no need for commentary around it for me. If you just put out some of the photographs, are absolutely wonderful. They're so atmospheric. Of course, it's very brutal in terms of barbed wire everywhere, border guards. To many people, it's abhorrent, but to me, it's very. It crystallizes a picture and enables you to imagine how you might feel as a person. And therefore, that makes it a lot easier to write, to imagine characters, to imagine how they might feel, you know, to empathise with them, and to come up with the stories that, you know, eventually, you know, come out, and the way you link, if you like, all the books together. So, research, yes, it's there, of course, and you try as much as you can to get everything right in terms historically speaking, but. You're allowed to let your imagination run a little bit, to adapt things if you like, but whilst trying to keep as close as you can to things that actually happened. You know, there are so many things that were going on in 1962 that it's difficult to get across to people now, how things like that could be going on. I mean, you've even got the West Berlin police blowing holes with explosive in the Berlin Wall, which is, when you think about that, that's how much the authorities in West Berlin were pushing not only the East Germans, but pushing the Americans and the Allies to act and do something about what was going on. I mean, there's one incident on Bernauerstrasse where there is literally a 10-foot hole in the wall that there was actually it was something to do with one of the West Berlin policemen who was involved with one of the escape organizations, or at least had links on this side. There was a cruise boat even where you had a family of East Berliners who hired a cruise boat for on part of the Landwehr Canal, and they hijacked it to get across to the other side. And, you know, they were all in the cabin, and there were bullets, you know, lots of bullets coming across from the East German guards. The family managed to get across to West Berlin. And then the two guys who were running the if you like, the pleasure boats, went back to East Germany. Obviously, they had family there. They went back to East Berlin. So, you know, it's very difficult to make people understand now what was going on. But if you put yourself in that position, it actually is. It's quite easy to write those things because you can only imagine how you feel about your own kids or your own family. It's not difficult then to go to the next step to understand the lengths that you might have gone to let's say, be reunited, or to be, as people might say, free and on the other side. So, yeah, that's, let's say, research, yes, but it's more about inspiration and imagination for me, if you like.
Much of what's in your book is based on fact, thinking about TV channels supporting the digging of tunnels and East German swimming stars being arrested for digging tunnels. So I think that's what gives it a real strong element of realism.
I'm a historian, so that's something which, I have a history degree, so it's something which always fascinated me. It's something which you know, it has to be right. You know, so many times you pick up a book and it's if you feel that the facts or something is not quite right, it's very difficult to get into the characters, to get into the story, for me anyway, at least. And I'm sure it's the same for other people. So from that side of it, yes, the history is really important to get those, let's say, get the facts right. So the research, and you know, you've touched on it yourself when you say that how do you make the research? It's something which is really important, but I think I'm trying to get across to the fact that, to me, it's almost stamped there already. So whilst you obviously check a lot of facts to hopefully make sure that you've not made some horrible mistake about which street leads to which street, or exactly how it was at a particular time to get through a border, you know, all these different things that can undermine a plot. So it's obviously you're trying to get those things, right. I think some of the other things which in this book I wanted to explore was a bit about, again, in 1961, 62, around this time, is the legitimacy of the DDR in a lot of people's minds. And I think that's something which...
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War, because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Maybe I'm a bit guilty of in the other books. I wanted to, let's say, put the other side of the story, because there is there was at that time a very strong, anti-fascist aspect to what the DDR was all about, and many people, you know, and you can see why if you look at what was going on at the time, believed in that. If you think about it, a lot of what the DDR, a lot of the propaganda, as it was, what they were putting out about the West German government employing ex-Nazi Party members in very, let's say, positions of power, positions of influence, it was true. You know, I was only talking to a colleague this week whose wife is German. Her father, he served in the Luftwaffe, and he was basically fighting like anybody else might in a war. He was called up. He told me he was bitter and resentful of the fact that in West Germany, when he came back from the war, by the time he got out of his prison of war camp, when he came back to West Germany, many of the party members had influential jobs, the best jobs. And, you know, the DDR and the government of the DDR at that time were very quick to point this out to people. And many of the times it was true. So there was a very strong legitimacy to the DDR for a lot of people with their anti-fascist stand. And also the fact that, of course, what happened when the Russians came to Berlin, when they came to Germany in terms of the, atrocities almost, I don't think that's too strong a word, for what happened when the Russians invaded. You know, in some areas, they still had a lot of support because of their stance against the Nazis and many of the things that they'd done during the war. And I think there was a strong legitimacy, and that's one of the things that I try to bring out in this book, and probably something which has been understated in the past. It's not just about people trying to escape. A lot of people wanted to be in. You know, they believed in the fact that something needed to be done to stop people fleeing the country for whatever reason. And if socialism, to a certain extent, was to be given its head, then, you know, something like a wall, even for a short-term period, was something that had to be done. And that's what some people believed. It's not, I wouldn't say it was maybe people not particularly in a majority, but it was quite a popular view at that time. So that's something which I've tried to bring out in the book, you know, to explore that side of things. It's not just about, you know, the bright lights of West Germany and West Berlin and the West, as you would say. It's about something a bit deeper than that, and something, let's say, in and around Berlin, but also in and around, let's say, the Soviet sector.
When you go back to Berlin now, what is your feeling of how Berliners and Germany more broadly deals with its Cold War past?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I'm qualified to answer that too much. I think what I can reflect on or what I can say is that looking at obviously the past, the Cold War is obviously linked to what happened in the Second World War and even before that. In many ways, it's a result of what happened before. So I think the way people have, the German population generally have reacted to the events of the Second World War since, the far more reflective and respectful of what's happened in many ways. And I think a lot of that has to do with the two opposing, sides of the spectrum. So there was a very broad view within the modern day state of Germany. So I think it's a very progressive way of looking at their past, probably more so than some other countries. As far as the Cold War is concerned, yeah, that's a bit more, you know, this is after the Second World War in terms of what's happened, and difficult to say in many ways, if you look at the Cold War as a separate entity, there's not much choice within Germany about how they deal with it, because it's imposed on them as a result of let's say the outcome of the Second World War, and it's difficult for it to be any different as to how it is. I think it is very much the German way, the progressive way now, not to hide from their past. So they obviously realized that there was a very much acceptance of why it was like it was, even if they didn't agree with it. And I think I always try to bring across very much the Berliners' view as to what they're feeling about what's happened. If you look at 1962 and you come to, for example, the anniversary, the one-year anniversary of the wall, even the view of the Allies, which of course wasn't always popular, and let's say more the Americans, the British, and the French, even though there was a popularity surge after the blockade, by 62, and especially what happened with Peter Fechter, that this incident. And the things that were leading up to the anniversary, so we're talking August 1962 now, there was almost quite a strong anti-US, anti-allied feeling at that time. And then, of course, when you had this incident where I think there were two guys, Peter Fechter and I can't think of his first name, but essentially he escaped, and Peter Fechter was in hiding behind one of the stanchions and was shot at the wall, right on Zimmerstrasse, which is just along from Checkpoint Charlie. It's very central. It's very in the public eye, if you like, and it probably, whilst everyone knew that people were getting shot, jumping off roofs around Bernauer Strasse, being shot while trying to swim the canals and the waterways, this was something which was very much in the face of everybody. Right at the anniversary, I think it's 17th of August, so it's 4 days after the anniversary, when there'd been riots or near riots around the wall, people. There'd been protests on the S-Bahn, which, of course, was East German or East Berlin. People were using taxis to slow down the traffic. This was leading up to what happened with Peter Fechter. Things changed around this time. So when Peter Fechter was left dying at the foot of the wall, there's a story of the American soldiers saying, look, it's not our problem. It's on East German soil. We can do nothing about it. It's actually reflected in the book, In Coercion. It's something where then there was a bit of a change in the way people viewed, I think, the Americans. The Soviet soldiers that were coming across the wall to the Soviet memorial just on just the other side of the Brandenburg Gate. For a week, the coaches were bricked, the windows were put through, the British had to guard the Russians coming to the monument. This was a real danger point, if you like. Berlin was always one incident away from a crisis at this time, and this was another one, if you like, simply because of the inaction. You know, they left a person to die at the foot of the wall who was crying out, you know, why don't you help me? And I think it was very poignant. And of course, there was the photographer, I think it was Wolfgang Behrer, who managed to get up. And it's covered in coercion. He's pushing his camera through the barbed wire on the top of the wall to take pictures of you know, poor Peter Fechter dying there. And it's a very emotive image. You know, the East German border guards didn't know what to do. They left him there for 40 minutes. Then they set off smoke bombs, which was pathetic, to try and cover the fact that they were lifting his body and taking him away. All these events, you know, changed, I think, views of the Berliners, of even the Allies at that time, and it took quite a long time for that to heal. So, yeah, talking about how the Germans have dealt with their Cold War past, it's everyone's got a responsibility in it, no more so than the superpowers and other people at that time. It's a real difficult one to answer, I would say, but you know, so many things going on and changing views because of the way things were dealt with. Maybe if different people would have been in charge at that time, or in that sector, just one action of an individual could have changed things, you know, quite markedly in terms of the reaction or crisis or anything else. So it's a difficult one to answer, but I think around this time and around the time of the book, that there's so many things that are going on and that shaped views for many, many years afterwards.
Presumably then this isn't an end to these books. You must have something else in the pipeline, surely.
It's a good question. I think I mean, I've written other things since. I'm working on a, let's say, something quite different. Whilst, believe it or not, there is a link back to the books that have already been written in some of the characters, although it's quite, I wouldn't say tenuous, but it's inside. I've actually written another book which is set in 1983-84, but starts, believe it or not, in East Berlin. And this is around the UK miners' strike of 84, basically 84, but it's a bit into 85 as well. And it's an alternate history book. But it starts with a kind of a very interesting event in 1977 when it's actually one of Arthur Scargill's editors for the Yorkshire Miner at that time, and this is it's a true story, was arrested picketing in London. And he felt that he was threatened, and he took off. He went to the airport and he flew to East Germany. He flew to East Berlin and he asked for political asylum because he felt he was being persecuted in the UK, or he feared for his life or that of his family in some way or another. And that inspires, if you like, the start of the book. So it's something which then comes back to the UK miners' strike. It follows, let's say, a little bit about the media during the miners' strike, but it's also linked to some of the spy agencies as well, and links back to it does have links back to Berlin. So it's interesting in terms of it's a different, totally different topic to what I've done before. It's in the Cold War period without, I would say, being something which is specifically linked to your podcast, but or the topic of the Cold War. But it's certainly set around that time. It's in the context of it, and a little bit in Berlin. And I'm writing a sixth book as a sequel to that, which is around, but back to East Germany, which is in the 80s, and also Ireland, or Northern Ireland. So that's all to come. It will take some time in between working and doing different things and other projects. But I'm certainly working on that and enjoying it. Looking at different topics, but still, Berlin always manages to get in there somewhere.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much indeed for coming back on Cold War Conversations. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks a lot, James. Appreciate it.
And we have further photos, videos and information on this episode in our show notes, which will show as a link in your podcast app. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. We'll be right back. Thanks again to all our financial supporters of the podcast, but a special thanks to our Politburo level Patreons, who are Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, and Jeffrey Jones, who are supporting us at $30 per month. Thank you. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.